Okay, guys, we're going to start up again. We're going to talk now. It's about 20 of 8, so we'll talk till about 8:30 and then leave some time for questions. And I have a homework assignment for you for tomorrow. So we're going to jump now into more about alcoholism. And this is the chapter that tells me why I have to come to Overeaters Anonymous. Because, like we said, if it was just the allergy, then what they could do is lock me in a room for 28 days, get all those alcoholic foods out of me. They could tell me not to eat those foods, and I would have the sanity to not eat those foods. And I always use the example with caffeine for me, because I do not drink caffeine. I have the reaction that I get migraines when I get caffeine. And that knowledge that I have migraines from caffeine is enough for me to not drink caffeine. So even though I abstain from caffeine, it's not part of my abstinence. Does that make sense? So the reason I come to Overeaters Anonymous is not because of the allergy, but because of the mental obsession. So this chapter is going to be about people that are abstinent, people that are sober, that make the insane decision to pick up. This is not going to be about people that are in the food trying to get abstinent, okay? So let's put, okay, so the first page, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different. So once again, it's letting us know, twofold illness, body and mind. Therefore, it is not surprising that in our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. So, and I don't know if this is going to mean anything, but this was important to me when someone really kind of clarify. I always thought that I was in denial. And the big book doesn't talk about denial. Denial means you know the truth and you're choosing not to do it. They're using the words illusion and delusion. And they're going to work us up into the word insanity. So delusion is that you believe it's true. I believed that I could control and enjoy my eating. Okay? If the reality was when I was controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. And when I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. So I am like the schizophrenic that hears the voices and believes they're real. Okay? I am like the person out in the middle of the desert that sees the oasis and believes it is there. And I had to recognize, too, my delusion was delusional. I did not want to eat like other people. Now, just looking from the age group in here, I think most of you guys will get this. I wanted to look like Anna Nicole Smith when she was in Playboy. But I wanted to eat like Anna Nicole Smith when she was in the VH1 special. The reality was that I wanted to eat like I wanted to eat. I just didn't want the consequence of it. Every night in high school, I prayed to God to be a size 14 because there was a store called 16 Plus in my area. And I didn't want to shop in the big girl stores. I don't think I ever asked to stop eating. So it's the consequences I wanted away, not the behavior. And they use this example down the bottom about we're like men who've lost their legs. And I like to use it very simply. I have quite a few people in here that wear glasses. Did you go through the conversation if today was a day you wanted to wear glasses or not? No. Do you wear glasses on your birthday? Yeah? Morgan, when you went on vacation, did you decide not to wear your glasses on vacation? That is what I have to fully concede. If I wear glasses, I do not go through the conversations that today's a day I just don't want to wear glasses. You know, I've crossed a time zone. I don't think I need to be abstinent on the West Coast. I think I only need to be abstinent on the East Coast. You know, or the big one. It's my birthday. My grandmother made it just for me. You know, I always think about that because my grandmother always had these butterscotch candies. And, you know, if I didn't have one, she would be so insulted. Now, my grandfather was an alcoholic and offered me beer every time I was there and a cigar. I never about telling Grandpa, I don't want to smoke a cigar, Grandma. But yet I feel bad saying, oh, Grandma, I can't not have that butterscotch. So that's the delusion we have in our mind. It's the way we rationalize things. So they're going to give us some different examples. The first one is the man of 30 on page 32. And he's someone that sees that his drinking is a problem. And he sees it's interfering with what he wants, which is he wants to be successful in business. So he puts the alcohol down for 25 years. And when he retires, he picks up the alcohol and he's dead within 4 years. And the one I like to read is on that last paragraph where it says a man of 30, about two-thirds of the way down. It says, he fell victim to a belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. And I think my experience in OA is, I've been at goal weight for 2 minutes. I should be able to eat now. Or I've been abstinent for, I was abstinent for 6 years. I should be able to break my abstinence so I can get out of this commitment and get right back on track. So that's the victim. Are we the victim that we think that our allergy disappears after a certain amount of time? Okay. If we go to page 34, that second full paragraph, this is what I really had to get. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. You know, I had talked to some people a few years ago. One was an inpatient rehab in California, and one was an inpatient rehab in New Jersey, and then an outpatient rehab in New Jersey. And they got them stable, and then they introduced dessert night. And on Tuesdays and Thursdays, they were told, what is your favorite dessert? And we're going to teach you how to eat one slice. If that was their reality, they're not a compulsive overeater of the type that's in here. So I have to be convinced that I am unable to eat moderately. Once again, unfortunately, there are some groups in OA that believe if you get through the steps, then you are going to be able to, with God's help, eat your binge foods moderately. That's not what the big book tells us. And once again, check your experience. Are the people that are saying that to you, are they still obese? Are they going in and out of the food? And my personal belief is if they're able to do that, they probably weren't compulsive overeaters to begin with. Because my book tells me I am unable to eat moderately. We are assuming, of course, that a reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power of choice to drink. So that, once again, is harkening back to the hard drinkers and the moderate drinkers, because a non-spiritual basis is anything that involves not doing the 12 steps. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or wish. So what my experience is I would make these red lines. You know, when I get to size 16, I'm going to stop. And then I'd get to a size 16, and I would say, I really meant 18. And I gave myself the illusion that I had still had control. It was, now I'm going to stop at a size 18. And then I get to size 18, and I would say, I think I really mean a 20. You know, or I would use an age or an occasion, graduate high school, graduate college. But when I really decided I was going to stop, I was baffled. I was absolutely baffled that I could not do it, because I kept giving myself this false illusion that it was a choice. Okay, so now what we're going to do is we're going to compare Jim and Fred. How many people know about Jim and Fred? So Jim is the alcoholic that loses everything and eats. That makes sense to me. Guy breaks up with me, of course I'm going to eat. No. Fred has the best day in the world, not a cloud on the horizon, and he eats. That baffled me. So let's talk about, you know, I hear people say, I'm a stress eater, I'm an emotional eater. If that's your reality, then eliminate the stress and you'll stop eating, right? Eliminate, the emotions, you'll be okay. So how many people here have eaten when they're happy? How many people have eaten when they're sad? Girl in the gray sweatshirt, smart girl keeping her hand up, not even putting it down. How many have eaten in a bad relationship? How many have eaten in a good relationship? How many have eaten when they had a bad job? How many have eaten when they got a promotion? So if that's your reality, you're screwed. Because there's no circumstance that will allow us to feel comfortable enough not to eat. And that's why I love comparing Jim and Fred. Because it's letting me know my reality is I cannot wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world by managing well. Okay? So if we go to the top of 36, we always talk about that squiggly writing on 36. You know, the whiskey and the milk, ha ha ha, isn't that funny? If I'm going to wait until I put the whiskey in the milk, I'm going to lose every time. It's like bringing a stick to a gunfight. I'm going to lose. So what I have to do is, what is going on before the thought comes into my mind? That's where I need a higher power. I need something to get between me and those thoughts. I do not believe I'm one bite away from a relapse. I said that for years. I'm one bite away. I believe I'm three or four thoughts away from a relapse, because it's in my thinking that allows me to believe that first bite. Once the end of my relapse is the first bite, the beginning of my relapse is that thinking. So let's look at the thinking that Jim had. Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. So Jim had a family business, automotive business, in his family for generations and lost it. And he's saying he's irritated. I would think he'd be enraged. How many of us has someone say, "How you doing, Kim?" "Fine, fine." And I am seething in resentment and anger and fear. And I had a few words with the boss. How many times have I said, "I had a few words with my mother," and I cursed her out like a sailor. So I can already see that he is in these emotions and not even understanding what he's doing. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. No intention of drinking. I just thought I'd get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which I was familiar with, for I'd been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober, sat down at the table, ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk, still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. So maybe it's different in California, but I actually work for an auto auction, and I know a lot of used car dealers. I have never been in a restaurant, a bar, or a coffee shop, and a used car dealer came up to me and said, "Hey, you need a used car." What is he going to show me? There's no inventory. So he, see that insane thinking? He's going to go into a bar and sell a car that he doesn't even have with him, probably. And he's saying, you know, I often hear people say, "Look, he's a compulsive overeater. He had a second sandwich." I don't believe that. I believe he's an alcoholic using any excuse he can to stay in the bar. Do you have Panera Bread around here? Mm-hmm. I don't know how many times. I like tea. I would sit in a Panera Bread, and have cup of tea after cup of tea after cup of tea until finally I had the bagel. I don't like tea that much. I'm putting myself in a situation where I'm going to eventually eat. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've been in an LA meeting where someone's crying and they can't get out of the food as they're sitting there with their Dunkin' Donuts mug. What are you doing in a Dunkin' Donuts if you can't get out of the food? That's the insanity that made the whiskey and the milk possible. Does that make sense? So what if I don't have to white knuckle it? What if there's a program that will allow me to get between me and that thinking so that I can get comfortable enough that I never think of putting the whiskey in the milk? And that's what these 12 steps do for us. Okay, so let's look at, turn ahead to page 40, where we are now talking about Fred. And Fred is someone that doesn't even believe he's an alcoholic because he still has everything. How many of us think, "Well, you know, I'm not 100 pounds overweight, so I can't be as bad as you guys. You know, bulimics to me are the worst." Well, I only throw up 10 times a day. I don't throw up 30 times a day. You know, I'm an exercise bulimic, so I'm not as bad as the bulimics that use laxatives. I just exercise a lot, and I like it. So by not believing that, he has an idea that he can do it differently than these alcoholics can. So if we go to page 40, the second full paragraph says, let him tell you about it. "I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas and the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. but I was confident it could not happen to me after all I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. That was my first 17 years in LA. Exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. So he goes about, has the best day, and he picks up. So they go back to him and they say, Fred, what happened? And just to jump ahead, this is a great story about sponsoring. Because when these guys pick up, what do? They bring them back to step one. They don't just say, well, where are you? We're just starting you from there. They bring them back because there's something in that foundation of powerlessness that's not there if you pick up. So they bring them back to step one whenever this happens. So at the bottom of page 41, we're going to see a promise. We talk about the promises in this program. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over the evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatsoever against the first drink. This time I had not fought the consequences at all. I commenced the drink as carelessly as though the ice cream was made from cows on organic curd on free range and were raised by Amish people. How bad can ice cream be? I now remember what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they promised that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. I don't know about you, but I can drink over a hangnail or a cancer diagnosis. It really doesn't matter. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism, and we have a lot of smart compulsive overeaters in LA, did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Two of the members of AA came to see me and they grinned, which I didn't like so much. And they asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic and if I were really lit this time. I had to concede both propositions. So to me, that is step one right there. That's the concession. Do you believe yourself an alcoholic of the type that we have just discussed? And are you lick this time? It doesn't say, are you willing to put the food down today? He says, are you done? Are you done? And I'll tell you, I think my experience is, and I talk to other recovered people, a lot of times we don't see our bottom until we're past it. So I'll explain to you when I knew I was done. I had broken my ankle 5 years ago in snow. I know you don't know what that is. In snow. And I slipped and I looked down and my foot was facing 180 degrees the wrong way. And I snapped the bone in my outer ankle, in my calf, and I tore every muscle and ligament. And I'm in the worst pain of my life. I'm laying in bed and I have my foot elevated, but anytime it goes below my heart, it was just horrific. So I was laying there and I had to go to the bathroom so bad. And I just thought to myself, I'm just going to pee in bed. I can't do it. I'm just going to pee in bed. And 10 minutes later, I thought, I really would like some pasta. And I got up and I walked to the kitchen, which I have to tell you is twice the distance than my bathroom, and sat there for the 8 minutes that it takes to boil pasta with my leg dangling in incredible pain. And it was that time that I thought, I'm done. I can't do this. I'm willing to pee in my bed, and yet I will still get up and make food. That was my jumping off point. But I did not see that till after I was recovered and through the steps and working with others and using my story to help them identify it. I'm like, that was it. That was the moment. Okay? So that's basically step one. So before we move to step two, I just want to give you a homework assignment for tomorrow. So I gave you these bookmarkers. And what this was actually an assignment we got from our inner group. And the assignment was, what if you're at a meeting and someone's brand new to OA and they come to you after the meeting and they say, I've only got 2 minutes. I want to know if I'm a compulsive overeater or not. What does that mean, and do I need to be here? How would you describe a compulsive overeater in 2 minutes? And then anyone who wants to, we'll start out tomorrow and you can read that. So from all the information that we've just gotten, how would you describe that? And this was what my homework assignment was, and somebody liked it, so they laminated it. Did everybody read it?
Yes.
Okay. That's what this is. This is saying, you know, what is a compulsive overeater, so you can tell a newcomer that. Okay? Any questions on that? I hope you guys participate, because that would be great.
Did you say 2 minutes?
And that will not be recorded. I'm sorry. Yes, true.
You say a 2 minute description?
Yeah, they call it an elevator speech. Like, yeah. If you are, you know, caught in the elevator with your salesperson and the executive is there, how would you sell your company in the elevator ride? So it doesn't need to be a full 2 minutes. I want a lot of people to have the chance to do it. So I don't, you know, if it's just a minute, that's fine. Okay. If somebody asked you, what is a compulsive overeater, because I need to know whether I need to be here, how would you describe to them what is a compulsive overeater so they know if they can identify it or not? Okay? So now that we've come to that conclusion that we are powerless, we're now going to talk about the second conclusion, which is step two, is I need a power. And I'm going to talk about, throughout the weekend, my own prejudices, my old ideas, that I thought step two was a belief in a God. And step two is not about belief in God. This chapter, we agnostics, which starts out on page 44, agnostics, the Greek origin of it is, agnostics is knowledge and ag is without. So it's those without knowledge. So what the chapter is going to try to do is not convince us that there is a God. The chapter is going to try to convince us that we need something outside of ourselves that is greater than us, or we're not going to recover. So I believe, personally, everything goes back to step one. Because if I'm not powerless, why do I need a power? And if I don't need a power, why would I make a decision in step three to seek that power? And if I'm not going to make the decision to seek the power, why the hell would I do the work of 4 through 9? So to me, everything comes back. So the powerlessness is what propels us to seek a power. And I personally, once again, I wasted a lot of time trying to define God, writing down the characteristics of God. One assignment I had was to write a letter of resignation for your God, and then make a help wanted ad for God, and then write your job description for God. And what I realized now is I was playing God. I was deciding who God was as a finite human being of what a power should be. An AA speaker I love talks about a God beyond his understanding, because if I can understand my God, he's not big enough. And let me tell you, the God that I had when I recovered is very different than the God I had 5 years later. And I hope the God that I had in 10 years from now is a lot different than I have now, because it needs to continue to grow and expand. And I find that people who are pure atheists actually have an easier time with this than the people that are overly religious, because they're afraid to question what God is. So there's no advantage of being a disbeliever or a believer in this. And that's why I want to keep it as general as possible. I'm going to use the word God, and if that bothers anyone, I think of it this way. I got to the point that I didn't care to set alcohol. I needed this program so I could easily substitute in food for it. I got to the point when I heard food, I understood what my binge foods were, and I didn't have to try to equate it with what your binge foods were, because I was that desperate. So the same thing. If you don't like the word God, I'm going to use it for simplicity's sake, and I'm going to use it because that's what the book says, but it can be whatever power that is greater than you. Can't be you. And if you need it to be the rooms for a short period of time, that's fine, but it can't be the rooms, because the rooms are going to disappoint you. It has to be something greater than yourself. Okay? So if we go to the first paragraph on page 44, it says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. So we're pretty good on that, right? You kind of really talked a lot about that. If, when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely, which is the mental obsession, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take. I always like to say, because I honestly, I didn't want to binge towards the end. I just needed to get the edge off. You know that feeling? You just need to get the edge off. So what I like to say is, if you can reasonably predict how much you're going to have of that food. I could never reasonably predict. Sometimes I could have a slice of pizza, once in a while. But I could never reasonably predict if I could have a slice of pizza. If that be the case, you're probably alcoholic. You may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So once again, it's that question, how free do you want to be? So one of the things I heard at a meeting a few months ago and just perked my ears up and it just made me realize what an alcoholic I am, or compulsive overeater, is someone said, you know, we have principles that are related to each step. You know, like I think I wrote them down here, but I can't remember where. You know, like one is honesty and two is faith and there's courage and integrity. And someone said, you know, even if you haven't done the steps, practice those principles that you can start out that way. And I thought to myself, that makes no sense to me. I know I should be honest. I don't have the ability to be honest until I work step one. You know, I know what's right and wrong. I personally grew up in a family with really good morals and I was taught right from wrong. I don't have the ability to do it on my own. That's my problem. So if I want to practice courage, which is step four, I got to do a step four. If I want to practice integrity, and I can't remember what step that is, then I have to work that step. That's how I'm going to learn these principles. I don't have the ability as a real compulsive overeater to just behave my way into right thinking. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I think that's what's exemplified here at the bottom of the page. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed us utterly. That's a great description of powerlessness. You know, my human resources, my best thinking, getting that right boyfriend, getting that right job, getting all my little ducks in order, the needed power wasn't there. So here we find out what our real problem is. Lack of power, that is our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, not a power by which we could eat, a power by which we could live. And it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. Now, if I had come in at 6 o'clock and we had read this, I don't think it would have been obvious. The reason that it's obvious is because we studied all the pages before. And that's why it's so essential that we start at the beginning of this book. But where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. So I remember being in a meeting with my home group a couple months ago now, and just kind of laughing to myself because the leader was a chiropractor. I had a Yale lawyer to my left. I had a nurse practitioner to my right. Across from me was an OBGYN doctor who also teaches at medical school, and a college professor on the other side. Lack of intellect is not our problem. You know, we are very smart and accomplished people, and Overeaters Anonymous, my experience is. It's not enough. It's not enough. So I have to recognize that lack of power is my dilemma. So we're going to go now to the bottom of page 46, that last paragraph, because this whole 12 steps is about action. That's what I got to do, is I got to take action. So it says, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe under the totality of things, we began to be possessed with a new sense of power and direction, provided we took a few simple steps. So once again, it's letting us know we have to do the work. We found that God does not make too hard terms for those who seek him. Action. To us, the realm of spirit is broad and roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. So you're going to see some examples in here of electricity and Christopher Columbus and all this idea. I just simply use my own experience with a GPS. I have no sense of direction. I mean, I get lost in hotels. You turn me around a couple times, I'm just powerless over it. And when a GPS was invented, it was like the best thing since sliced bread. But did I feel when I got that GPS, I was like, okay, I need to find out who the engineer is. I need to know how this was developed. I need to know where these satellites are up in the air. You know, I need to know where the patent is. No, I just knew that I had no ability to find my way around, and that when I put that on, and I put a directions in there, and it said turn in 500 feet, I turned in 500 feet. And it said made a left, I make a left. And if I made a mistake and it said recalculating route, I recalculated my route. That is what I had to do with my higher power. I didn't know. I couldn't figure it out. And I personally come from a religious background. I'm a Catholic school kid. So I had to let go of a lot of my old ideas of what God was. Because through my step work, I found that I thought God was priests and nuns. Priests and nuns can't live up to that. You know, a nun was mean to me in third grade, so I hated all nuns. You know, I had justifiable anger about some stuff that happened in my church. I had to let that all go because my powerlessness demanded that I find a power greater than myself. So if we look at the top of page 48, it's going to talk about that. It says, we often found ourselves handicapped, first line on 48, by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. Many of us have been so touchy that even a casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned, not reconsidered, not tweaked, had to be abandoned. Though some of us resisted, we found no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was the great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. So, you know, one of the things I had to really look at with the directions in the big book is if someone wasn't going to stop eating, I can't help them. I'm not going to convince anybody they're a compulsive overeater. You know, what's going to convince them is go back into your pantry and see if you can control and enjoy your eating. Because until someone's out of ideas, they're not going to be open to this. That's why it's the two alternatives. Door number three, I'm going to pursue that until I have no other ideas. So I love that word handicapped, and the definition of that is a condition that markedly restricts one's ability to function. That describes my disease. And what am I handicapped by? Obstinacy. That's my arrogance. Another AA speaker that I love says, it's not what we don't know that will kill us, but what we know for sure that isn't true that will kill us. My sensitiveness, man, you couldn't talk to me about anything without me crying or raging. You know, an unreasoning prejudice. So what's prejudice? I had a prejudice about prejudice. I thought prejudice meant you didn't like black people, you didn't like gay people, you didn't like you West Coast people are bad, or you think these East Coast people are bad. Prejudice is simply a prejudgment. So what were my prejudgments about God, religion versus spirituality? What were my prejudgments about the 12 steps? What were my prejudgments about Overeaters Anonymous? What are my prejudgments about what a compulsive overeater is? Those were holding me back. I had to, you know, set all that aside and try to look at this with a new experience. And why was I willing to look at it with a new experience? Because my step one was so in place because I was so screwed if I didn't do it. Okay? So let's go to page 52. Because these are the bedevilments. Everyone know what the bedevilments are? So the bedevilments, I'm going to read them. And someone told me, which was very helpful to me, to read them in first person and to read them when abstinent. So it's the second full paragraph. We had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems with the same readiness to change our point of view. Was I having trouble with personal relationships when abstinent? Couldn't I control my emotional nature when abstinent? Was I a prey to misery and depression when abstinent? Couldn't I make a living when abstinent? Did I have a feeling of uselessness when abstinent? Was I full of fear when abstinent? Was I unhappy when abstinent? And couldn't I seem to be of real help to other people when abstinent? And the reason that was powerful for me, because if I really thought that I only was suffered from these bedevilments when I was in the food, then abstinence would cure that. But if this is my reality in abstinence, then I need to find a different solution. And for me personally, once again, when I got to that place where food was oblivion and I didn't feel anything, these bedevilments weren't there when I was in the food. I didn't feel anything. Abstinence is what brought all these to the surface. So I was going to have to find a different solution. So this next paragraph was my personal step two. It says, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance on the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. So my powerlessness, my way of doing things, I am a failure. I have tried everything, and I cannot stop eating. I cannot stop binging. I cannot stop over-exercising. I cannot, you know, anything. I was just totally powerless. And I heard people identify themselves as recovered. And this God thing seemed to work for them. And my belief it worked for them was enough for me to do step two. That was it. I didn't have to believe in anything else except that I believed it worked for them. Does that make sense? So we're going to go over one more thing and then open it up for questions. On page 55, we find out where we look for this power. So on 55, that second paragraph, it says, actually, we are fooling ourselves. For deep down, every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we have to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. We can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony sweeps away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. So if God is deep down within every one of us, why can't I feel it? That's because I've put so much crap between me and God. So the whole entire step process is actually an undoing, if we think about it. So let's look at the action steps. Steps 4 and 5, we look at our resentments, our fears, and our sex conduct. We get rid of that. Then in 6 and 7, we identify those defects that are blocking us from being useful to God and the people around us, and we get rid of them. And then in 8 and 9, we get rid of our guilt and our shame and remorse on how we've treated others. And by doing that process, we become unblocked from the power that's always been there. And it says, with this attitude, we cannot fail. What is the attitude? Look at the sentences before it. We have to be willing to sweep away prejudice, which means we have to open our minds. We have to think honestly, and we have to search diligently. So when we come to that conclusion that we need a power, that's going to propel us to make a decision in step 3 to seek that power by doing 4 through 9. Okay? So that is it. We are done doing step 2. So I'm going to stop the thingy.